Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
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 And today we are reading Hagseed by Margaret Atwood, which is not a science fiction book.
Or fantasy.
Or fantasy.
I don't know, we can argue that. It's kind of low fantasy.
Sure.
I liked it.
Yeah, but in any case, Barry, can you tell us what's going on with this book?
Sure, from the back of the book. Our greatest literary innovator and beloved novelist has reimagined Shakespeare's final great play of magic and illusion. Entertaining, gripping, emotionally rich and wise, Hagseed is an homage to a master, positioned for the fall celebrations of the 400th anniversary of the bard's death. Quote, "It's got a thunderstorm in it, and revenge. Definitely revenge," end quote. Felix is at the top of his game as artistic director of the Mekeshawik Theater Festival. His productions have amazed and confounded. Now he's staging a tempest like no other. Not only will it boost his reputation, it will heal emotional wounds. Or that was the plan. Instead, after an act of unforeseen treachery, Felix is living in exile in a backwoods hovel, haunted by memories of his beloved lost daughter Miranda and brewing revenge. After 12 years, revenge finally arrives in the shape of a theater course at a nearby prison. Here, Felix and his motley crew of inmate actors will put on his tempest and snare the traitors who destroyed him. But will it remake Felix as his enemies fall? Margaret Atwood's novel take on Shakespeare's play of enchantment, revenge, and second chances leads us on an illusion-ridden journey with new surprises and wonders of its own.
All right, so what did everybody think?
It was awesome.
Actually, I agree.
Wait, it was awesome.
Yeah, so despite the fact that this is not science fiction or fantasy in a technical sense, this was one of the favorite books that we've read for this, really.
Right. Yeah. And again, I was going to say, you can give a real long stretch and say it's low fantasy because he's hallucinating his dead daughter and other people hear it, so maybe.
If we're going to start stretching definitions, then I'm going to just basically call anything fantasy because, wow, it involves people that might not exist.
If you dig down a couple layers, there's magic.
Yep.
Sure.
Magic of the heart, Steve.
That I don't understand these things. So personally, I thought that this was a fantastic novel. Since I started reading Margaret Atwood with Handmaid's Tale, I go into every Margaret Atwood basically expecting to be bonked on the head.
Extreme terror.
Yeah, exactly. When Barry suggested, oh, we should do another Margaret Atwood, I'm just like, I'm going to really respect it, but it's going to rip my heart out of my chest. But this was actually a lot of fun. I mean, very emotional and so forth. But a lot of the theatrical stuff was very realistic. I think that towards the end, we got a little bit unrealistic in a human sense, but that was kind of necessary to have the parallels to the play that we have. So it's a nested structure where someone's regular life mirrors Shakespeare's The Tempest, and he's also involved in putting on productions of Shakespeare's The Tempest. So there's a lot of narrative and structural fun being had in that.
It's like meta, meta, meta.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes. The Tempest, the original Tempest itself was had this meta element to it.
Oh, yeah.
So
Shakespeare loved doing that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's always the tendency to sort of say, oh, well, this is about a playwright and the magic of his craft, when, for all we know, there was just a really strong demand for magical wizards on island fantasies right then. But
right.
You know, this is a very enjoyable book. You know, it was a great listen, and I think for a lot of people, this would make the original Tempest very accessible to them now. Even in high school, I remember, you know, sort of struggling with Shakespeare. And
The Tempest is a weird play.
It says so in the book.
Well, that's true. But I mean, like even Midsummer Night's Dream, you can sort of immediately see that it's sort of a romantic fantasy of various kinds. Whereas this, there's nothing obvious about, well, of course, it's all about this enchanter and his daughter that are exiled on this island and the things that happen to them.
Yeah. I mean, so for me, my exposure to Shakespeare was pretty limited. You know, in high school, I basically took an English class and somehow I got stuck in the class with the football jocks at the end of the day. And so the teacher had kind of given up on the class to start with. And so when we got to the sort of like the 2 months we were going to do on Shakespeare out of the year, we literally watched Romeo and Juliet and wrote a quote book report.
Movie review.
It was sort of soul shattering, but
Kevin, what did you have to say?
Yeah, I thought it was really well done. And considering that I didn't really know that much about The Tempest, it was kind of like an English class about The Tempest in the book.
Right.
So they kind of explain what happens in the motivations behind the characters, like as you go, you know. And so that was sort of interesting to kind of be able to deconstruct it a bit during it as well. And one thing which I didn't get a chance to do was I was like, well, you know, before we record this, I should, you know, I should watch some version of The Tempest, which I didn't, primarily because the last last chapter was sort of a...
That's actually something I would recommend is, weirdly enough, skip to the very last chapter, and listen to that first, because that is essentially the Cliff's Notes to The Tempest.
Right, and I was trying to decide whether it's, you know, is it better to go in knowing The Tempest or not? And usually I would say, well, yes, you should know the source text first. In this case, I would say if you don't know it, it adds a little bit of tension because you don't know how it's going to end.
Oh, okay.
So, like, I didn't know, for example, blank or, you know, would this happen, you know? So, yeah, there was definite tension that I wouldn't have had if I knew that this was going to parallel the structure, so... I don't know. I guess it's up to the reader.
I actually read the Wikipedia entry and had a very coarse idea of what was going to happen during the book. And as you said, it removes a lot of the tension of not knowing what's going to happen next, but it allowed me to focus a lot more on the characters that the author was building on and explaining and machinations, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that there are advantages either way, yeah. Maybe. So,
right.
I mean,
it's maybe, kind of like when they say, you know, should you read the introduction before you read the book or something? And
right. Perhaps I was in a really good place for it because I studied The Tempest when I was in college, but that was quite some time ago, so it's kind of gotten a little bit rusty since then.
Yeah. I mean, just on the book itself, it was very well written, again, like as Margaret Atwood, obviously.
Right.
But I thought it was interesting that it's very infrequent when I read a book that I actually sort of like get shivers down my spine or something like that, and like which I don't ever expect to happen. And, you know, when they actually started The Tempest in the book, that kind of happened where I was sort of like all excited for some reason, like, you know, what's this weird thing happening? Like... emotional response. I don't quite understand.
I'm actually having a reaction to a book I don't understand, and it's not pure hatred.
It is a strange feeling.
Actually, you know, I have to agree with Kevin on that one. You know, I actually, you know, I'm thinking back to, you know, when I was listening to the book and thinking to myself, I actually have like really good feelings about listening to this book, even though, you know, it's a story about revenge, which isn't always necessarily a wholesome act.
Right.
But, it still makes me feel good. I don't know why. I mean,
well, also, it's definitely revenge, and it's definitely life-altering revenge, but it's not like horrible, horrible graphic revenge.
Well, yes, and, you know, perhaps we all want to get some revenge against former coworkers for various reasons.
Stick it to the man.
Since we're all former coworkers of each other, we should all watch out.
Look, there was no dismembering, no disembowelment.
Well, I will say it actually kind of made me want to, you know, go to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, actually, you know, watch, you know, because like I went to see last year some, I don't even remember now what it was, but some Shakespeare play that I wasn't that familiar with. And I'm like, oh, I should actually go see more of this culture stuff.
Yeah, I actually haven't gone to see Shakespeare in quite some time. I think my last real engagement with Shakespeare was when I was trying to translate Henry IV Part 1 into Klingon.
Good job. I would
it
like to hear how many
so much more sense
how many kaplas show up.
I mean, the hero is a different person. That happens a lot when you translate things into Klingon.
Is that General Chang from Star Trek 4 or whatever it was?
Well, no, he was more into Hamlet. But anyway, I think that this has gone on far enough.
Yes. The play is the thing phrase, even though it's not in this play, did get stuck in my head for a while after listening to the book.
So we're going to take a brief break and come back to do a full-on discussion of Hagseed by Margaret Atwood, for we are Sci-Fi.
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 Tip of the tongue, top of the teeth.
Tip of the tongue, top of the teeth.
Yeah.
Tip of the tongue, top of the teeth.
Well, now we know what Kevin says to his victims right before the knife goes in. But we are back with a full discussion of Hagseed by Margaret Atwood. So this book was multi-layered and very explicitly so. So we have the top level, which is about this dramatist and director and actor who's putting on plays and trying to find revenge against people that betrayed him earlier in life. And normally I would find that sort of thing kind of excruciating because, you know, there's so much obvious parallel between the top story and the lower level story of The Tempest. But the thing that made it awesome was that he was noticing it as he was going along and sort of making it happen as well.
Yeah, I mean, he almost used it as like a realizing it was a template, you know, whether it was conscious in the beginning or not.
He knew that his daughter was not really there, but he sort of shaped his day-to-day existence around her anyway.
Right. So I guess, theoretically, the least interesting possible discussion about this is it fantasy?
I mean, there's a certain fantasy aspect to it. His daughter passed away when she was 5, right? Which was a number of years ago in the book.
Well, she passed away, and so he's hallucinating her. He's fired not too long after that, right?
Yeah.
You know.
And the interesting thing is it's kind of a choice to hallucinate her. He knows that she's not really there in some ways, but he's just using it as a crutch.
Well, yeah, it's like he's so devastated that he can't deal with her being gone, so he happily sort of encourages the hallucination so he could still talk to her. He sees her growing up, and because he sort of self-exiled himself for 9 or 10 years before the play The Tempest goes on, right? So,
well, I mean, it's not only he's using her as a crutch, but he's also using her sort of like as a power source, right? I mean, it's something that makes him want to keep going forward and, you know, finally get his revenge. So there's a certain two-sided nature to that dynamic.
There are a couple of things that I thought were neat touches. First of all, we very rarely or never get actual quotes from her. It's all sort of secondhand. She said that, you know.
Right. It's all hearsay, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And also, there was one amusing thing towards the end where he was considering how to tell her that no one else could see her.
Right. Yeah. He's like, that would hurt her feelings, and she might get confused. And then he's like, I don't know whether she would then go away or whether she would just freak out or what.
Right. And so how to tell something that you know is your own hallucination, that it's your hallucination.
Right. It's like sort of quasi-autonomous. You know?
Right.
There's also sections in the book where he's talking about being very self-conscious about, you know, pretending to get her out of the back seat of the car.
Right.
And, you know, he knows that no one else can see her except for him.
Right. And he's sort of like, I'm glad no one was there to see me open the door for somebody that wasn't there.
Yeah.
And
kind of reminded me a little bit of an experience I had where, so I'm a dog owner and I have a tendency to talk to my dogs more than just, you know, most people just like, oh, here, you know, I will happily lecture the dogs about whatever it is popping into my head.
The real question is do they talk back to you?
Woof.
Woof. Something more.
We love you.
I've met the family dogs, and I don't think they'd actually be able to exceed their laziness factor to actually respond to anything.
They can be a bit more energetic at some points, but this has been Stephen Reviews His Own Dogs.
So the fact that this is supposed to be, you know, the events of the book parallel The Tempest, they're talking about during the discussion on The Tempest that, you know, is Ariel a real character or is it part of Prospero's imagination? And then they kind of say, well, other people hear her or hear Ariel a couple times. Mm-hmm. So, and that's kind of how Miranda's, you know, ghost or hallucination is, right? Where most of the time she's just his hallucination, you know, very obviously. And then, you know, Eight Hands hears her in the microphone or the headphone feedback, and he thinks, "Oh, I'm hearing feedback of when I say something." And then, you know, he kind of says, "Well, you know, speak more softly because, you know, his daughter is sort of doing the understudy for Ariel because she really wanted to be in the play, you know,
right?"
And convinced him to take her there,
right? And so there is sort of a dual reality where perhaps it is just, you know, technical glitches and he's interpreting it as his daughter is there.
Right. And then towards the end where, you know, again, one of the prisoners hears his daughter saying something about, I don't remember the phrase now, but it was like a song he sung her when she was really young.
Right.
And so it's like, well, how could that possibly be, you know, how, you know, someone else is hearing it and sort of saying it. And then also at the end where he's doing the actual like revenge part and, you know, his daughter kind of, you know, speaks to him and she's the one who kind of says, be merciful.
Right. I remember from when I took a few classes on Shakespeare that there are productions that actually don't have Ariel appear on stage, that there's like an off-screen light and just an off-screen voice or something like that. And I think that some of the stuff that Felix has done are references to some of these sort of classic experimental productions of The Tempest, such as giving the guy flashlights and... you know, portraying him more as a technological figure in some ways.
Yeah, the costume made me think of Ultraman, now that you were sort of describing it, where he had the kind of bug-eyed silver glasses.
And oh, that would have been fantastic, because then he could have had the color timer go off at various points.
Right, he would do his little, like, cross-arm, like thing and shoot out lightning and stuff. That would be...
Well, thanks.
Yeah, so another aspect of this, you know, with Margaret Atwood, there's usually a lot of social justice and things in it. And I mean, given that her most recently published book before this, The Heart Goes Last, was all kind of around like the prison industrial complex and a lot of really fuzzy things related to that. So,
but this, it's a little blue bear.
Right. So this one, you know, being that it's centered a lot in prisons, obviously touches on some of that where it's like, you're being punished. So, you know, shouldn't you just, you know, be punished and not have some enriching thing to give you, you know, skills, you know, to give you some kind of redemption? Or on the other hand, you know, is that part of the function of the correctional system to kind of like remove you from that part of society and kind of have you go into more, quote, productive parts of society?
Yeah, I mean, so that's sort of like the function of Sal and Tony, right? I mean, she makes it really easy to not like them very much because they're trying to take the acting program away from the prison.
Right.
You know, without ever actually having seen it. You know, it's like, oh, it's just a waste of money. It's, you know, right, not going to improve their lives in any way and not going to certainly improve their behavior on the outside if they ever get out.
Right. And so it's like, you know, we're not really socially progressive. We're just like, that's a waste of money. And they're there to be in prison, not to like, you know, have these special perks like, you know, Shakespeare festivals in prison. Right.
If you commit a crime, then you will be forced to take part in a Shakespeare festival.
No.
Yeah. The only thing that I got kind of iffy about towards the end of the book was I didn't believe that Felix would be able to actually pull this off and emerge unscathed, no matter how amazing his dramatic production was.
Right. And I didn't, like I said, I didn't know really the plot in detail other than, you know, The Tempest was, I don't know, some like magician guy in some storms or something on an island. That right. was about what I knew about it.
Yeah.
I mean, his plan seemed to be drug people and hope that other people around them will say something so compromising that they can then use it to blackmail them into not right. taking retribution.
And you're right. That was the most unbelievable part, but, you know, also probably as believable as maybe the original play where it's like, you know, sure. they were all bad and, you know, very black and white characters on some of them.
Well, in some ways, it's sort of like a perfect storm of circumstances, right? And things coming together. I mean, even the fact that he was able to, you know, get one of those guys to install the video and microphone units in the area they were going to be performing in and have
right.
those guys as guests. I was like, this doesn't really sound very much like a prison. It sounds like, you know, the inmates are sort of running things around there.
Right. It's sort of like, this is an unused portion of the thing, so we could do what we want. And yes. I mean, some of that stuff did seem unrealistic, but... you know, if you think of it as a fantasy, it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a maximum security prison.
Right.
They basically said that all of the really violent criminals were somewhere else.
That's true. They did basically say this was like just people that had done, you know, minimal embezzlement or whatever, and, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Actually, part of it was my brain just went to, oh, I see what's going to happen. They're going to put him in prison at the end, and he's going to wind up.
Yeah, I actually, because I didn't know in The Tempest that what they did was not fatal. So I was expecting the goblins just surround everybody and just slaughter them. Like, ah, I got my revenge, mofos. And like, and just like, until he went and saw, you know, Eight Hands, his buddy drug dealer outside, and kind of, they said, oh, this isn't fatal and stuff. And I was, and then what happened was when he's like, okay, this is intended not to be fatal, but then they said, oh, they'd come in from another party and had a few drinks. And I was going, oh, there's going to be some weird bad interaction with their previous drinking, and they're all going to like go into comas or something.
Unintended murder.
Yeah, or they would actually, you know, have heart attacks. And I was like, oh, he was going to end up in the prison and still running the thing.
Well, it's like from very early on, I was wondering how he was going to get his revenge and get his job back, right? I mean, that's sort of where I always saw the book going. I didn't think that he was going to have them, you know, torn, you know, limb from limb in the prison or anything. I certainly was not expecting sort of the spontaneous admission of facts or
right, exactly
thoughts.
But at that point, really, we have to just accept that reality is sort of being bent by the narrative, shall we say? Yeah. It's a Seanan MacGuire.
Yeah, thing. I just, as you said that, I was like, yeah, it's the narrative is controlling them now.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay, no, now it's perfect.
Shakespeare is a fable.
Yeah, if you take this and put it into the Seanan MacGuire indexing universe, then it makes perfect sense. He's just manipulating the narrative. Of course he can do it. He's a brilliant dramatist, and it all makes perfect sense, and it is science fiction.
I could force you into the structure of a book.
And sold! I am sold.
I am a metafable, my friend.
And then there were the Hagseed players or whatever they were, which I'm not going to try to do.
One, two, three.
Hagseed.
This entire podcast is just an excuse for us to say something in unison every once in a while.
Well, I probably spent the first half of the book trying to figure out what a hag seed was, you know, and then I finally, you know, did some Googling around, and I was like, oh, okay, so it's just another name for, I guess they call Caliban a hag seed, you know, it's the offspring of a witch.
Right.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, so now I understand, you know, where that comes from, and it made it even more awesome.
Yes.
Yes.
It was never mentioned in this book that Caliban was the offspring of Sycorax, but I mean, it's mentioned in the Wikipedia entry and sort of historical context, I think.
It's said in the play.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I just wasn't sure if it was mentioned in the book itself.
Yes, it is at the end when they're sort of wrapping up and explaining.
The Cliff Notes chapter, yes.
No. The one
prior to that? Okay.
The one where they're saying where they think that the...
what happens next?
What happens next? Because that was kind of a funny part, whereas I was saying...
That was neat, I thought.
Oh, yeah. They have all the prisoners say what they think is going to happen to their characters next. So the guy who plays Caliban says, oh, well, what if it turns out that Caliban is Prospero's son? Which is actually one of the interpretations that you can sort of find in the literature, because there is that really interesting line that I was sort of getting a little bit frustrated that the book was never saying, which is, this thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine.
Which they do eventually.
And just like, he's doing his whole presentation, he's just like, there's that one line, and, you know, I chorused it along with the book. This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine. Okay, yeah, now I'm with you, finally. Kind of cathartic. For me, it was sort of a great reminder of how much fun it can be to read Shakespeare. Because some of the time I'm never really sure how good is Shakespeare really, and how much have we sort of piled on the interpretations and, you know, taken this sort of really weird equivocal text and found ways of making it work. And I don't think it matters in some weird ways. I think that you can have a really interesting experience going through the ideas of this 16th, 17th century, you know, random guy wandering around London just trying to make a buck off of writing scripts.
Right. I mean, my understanding also is that, you know, a lot of the Shakespeare you read now isn't necessarily a literal transcription of what occurred in the play. It's people from people's memories and what was written down sort of as notes and
exactly.
Things, right? I mean, it seemed like it was all very rehearsed, very orally, and you know, maybe with some rough notes or something.
Right. Some of the plays that we have are apparently transcriptions of some of the, like, working notes that he had. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, they talk about that in the book, that most of these are just what his friends wrote down afterwards. Some of these are probably based a little bit on other people trying to rip off the plays.
Yeah, and maybe a fair amount of improvisation as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so for such a central part of the literature, and then also, you know, if you look at the original texts, you will see that, oh, well, what we have in the first folio is this, but that's gibberish, so we're going to assume that it's this line instead.
Okay. That was actually something that I also really enjoyed was, you know, the conversations he had with the prisoners, trying to get them to play the parts that seemed more feminine or less manly, right? Mm-hmm. You know, he's like, well, we don't have to have, you know, the fairy really be a fairy, you know, like, let's, you know, let's have a discussion about like, what is the fairy capable of doing,
right?
Right. And they kind of, you know, get accustomed to, you know, now I want to play this part because it's, you know,
right. They're like, well, what
way
is
more
it?
Powerful than
it's like someone they could fly, they could cause lightning and stuff. And it's like, oh, they sound like a superhero, you know, when out of context. And
yeah, that was the thing that I really liked. First of all, that he just sort of took to this so well and had respect for the prisoners. I mean, in some ways they were a little bit a means to an end, but he was, at the beginning I was quite worried that this would be a story of somebody that was basically abusing the other prisoners to get his own revenge. And I should have frankly known better.
Well, in some ways he was kind of manipulating them, right? I mean, he's he's certainly prompting them in certain directions. You know, and you know, like when we just talked about,
right.
Oh, you know, it's like, it's not a fairy, it's, you know, it's like a superhero, right? It's this, he sort of just nudged them in various directions to.
Exactly. But some of that is just teaching. In fact, a lot of that is just teaching when he's, you know, yes, he wanted to do a specific thing, but he, first of all, he didn't really lie. I expected that at the end, this was going to be something that blows up in his face because he was going to have to lie to the prisoners in order to get them to carry out some kind of attack.
Right. I mean, so, it, you know, they spent about a chapter talking about the previous plays that he did, you know, Henry V, and I can't remember the other ones, you know, which were much more, you know, straightforward and quote,
right.
more accessible, right, to the prisoner mindset,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I think was explicitly said.
Yes, so. It was. And that he had to really draw out the themes that he thought that they would be able to understand, such as revenge.
Which the Tempest has plenty of.
The Tempest is is all about revenge.
Sweet, sweet revenge.
I don't know how long we want to keep doing our usual questions, but we'll throw them in there.
I love our usual questions.
Okay. Was there tea? You know, I don't remember.
I think there was definitely coffee.
There was plenty of coffee. I don't remember. I think there was some talk about tea at some point.
I want to say maybe he made tea in his shack or something, but I can't remember.
That's true. Was there an awkward sex scene? Not a one.
You're right. I don't think there was one.
I don't think so. There was, you know, innuendo towards that direction, but not anywhere near,
well,
really.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so like when Anne Marie is brought in to play Miranda, right? You know,
right.
He's kind of worried that, you know, she's kind of worried that like, oh, the prisoners might attack me or something like that. But she's a very powerful, you know, physically right. powerful person, right? And I actually really enjoyed those descriptions of like the dance scenes that she does.
Yeah.
You know, where she's sort of just, you know, the two dancers are sort of physically handling one another.
Right.
Well, they did say that dancing was about romantic love, so I guess that's as close as you'll get. But
yeah, he shows that to the prisoners, and rather than being super titillated, they're just like, oh my God, she could take you apart.
Right. They're like, she'll kick your ass if you know, you try to do anything to her.
Mental note, unless I want, you know, something broken.
Yeah. So, and yeah, I thought that was interesting.
I mean, there was sort of a... an element there where, you know, when they're talking about the, you know, that where the characters go from there at the end,
mm-hmm.
you know, they said, oh, it's like, oh, you know, Anne Marie would have been, you know, raped or something.
Right.
Right. Caliban and all the bad guys would.
Right. That's just how it would happen, lady, you know. Sorry, it's the truth.
Right. And she comes up with this, you know, amazing thing where, you know, no, she's still got magic and she wins.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought that that would sort of push it back and that would be incorporated into the group narrative. But no, they keep on saying, no, I think that, you know, that wouldn't have happened. The goddesses aren't real.
Right.
But, you know, so I'm not sure what to do with that.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say that. I certainly wouldn't characterize that as an awkward sex scene. I mean, it was a very frank discussion about what the people in the play actually thought was going to happen to the the characters in the book or in the script.
Yes. It actually reminds me a bit of my Shakespeare classes where the people in the classes would often try really hard to put a modern sensibility on Shakespeare that, oh, well, Shakespeare was really for women's rights and liberation. It's just like, there's no reason to think that that would be true or that that could be true. He was a person of his time. And, you know, certainly, as is even pointed out, Prospero is trying not to do your standard arranged marriage, but he's trying to arrange a marriage nonetheless.
Yeah.
You know, he is working behind the scenes to try to get two people to fall in love, and that actually happens in the real story as well, a little bit, because...
See, the narrative's working. Because they actually did.
I really like the Shauna Maguire interpretation of this.
It's not a meta interpretation. It's what is it? It's almost like a mashup.
I believe we just call it a delusion, and I'm comfortable with that.
Should I knock you on the head with a hammer?
No. I'll just develop an imaginary daughter.
So I think we also have a third question, usual question that we sometimes skip over is: do we have a favorite scene? I think my favorite scene for some reason that really stuck out for me was when he sort of goes out with his shopping list and he's like, it's like goes to the toy store and he's like, I need some Disney princesses. And
for your daughter?
Yeah, for your daughter. I'm like, oh, that's got to be a real kick in the doggy bag, right?
And he's just like, I'm more like an honorary uncle. And well, maybe Canada's different.
She's like, oh, you must, you know, it seems like you have a daughter of your own, you know, and
yeah, that.
Well, I do, or I did.
She's standing over there, but you can't see her.
Right. Yeah, that kind of threw me for a loop at first when there was, you know, the Canadian government related stuff. And I was like, huh? At first, and I'm like, oh, wait, this, you know, Margaret Atwood's Canadian, so this makes more sense.
Right. No, I think for me, the most cathartic point was the Caliban musical at the end.
Yeah, I actually really liked all of the Hagseeds, yeah. You know, stuff where they would do the songs about stuff, you know, from the point of view of Caliban, but or by Caliban in the play. But, you know, I guess one thing that sticks out for me, too, was and I don't, you know, you may remember the line, but it was the line that his daughter prompts him at the end where she's like, you know, there's some eloquent line about, you know, you should, instead of trying to get revenge, you should, you know, be merciful. And I don't remember.
Sorry, that's not in here.
Yeah. There was my head.
You can't see me pointing at my head on the podcast.
There, see? I'll find it in there.
We'll have to take a picture. Yes.
But yeah, there was some line that, you know, said it in a more eloquent way that... But yes.
Just imagining the Kevin transcripts of Shakespeare.
And then they did something over here, walked or something.
And then I said, set me free.
Oh, that was actually a neat thing that reminded me of something from one of my Shakespeare classes when he was talking about the final prison at the end.
Yeah.
Because it reminded me of something they were talking to me about in one of my classes, which was that... some Shakespeare plays end with sort of an explicit appeal for applause. But
it's done now. Please clap.
And so, you know, apparently the Prospero speech at the end where he's talking about, you know, I'm trapped here unless you set me free. That's actually, unless you set me free with your prayers. Apparently that was sort of like your prayer was going like this. You know, putting your hands together in front of your face as though praying, which is clapping sound. So with your good prayers, it's just like, you know, Jeb Bush's please clap.
It's just the equivalent of the applause sign.
Yeah, exactly. It's just and
so that would be the modern version of it, you know,
pretty much
on the applause sign.
But I remember in one of my classes, there was somebody was saying that there was a production where the guy playing Prospero was just told, okay, you can't leave the stage until they start clapping. And that's a bit of a problem because normally, you know, they
don't clap till the lights come down.
Yeah, they don't clap until the lights go down, exactly. And so sometimes he would just have to stand there for a minute or two when somebody would get the idea and start applauding.
I'm going to do something. This is awkward, so I'll just start clapping. Thanks.
Yeah.
Exactly. He could just start clapping.
it sort of increases the actor's, you know, tremendous nightmare at the end. What if they don't applaud? Then I can't leave the stage.
I'm trapped here forever.
I do like the sort of the meta interpretation more of the, you know, this play is quasi-real or something.
Right. And unless you actually show mercy and forgive people, perhaps, then you are stuck in this. And, you know, we do have a tendency to come up with the worst possible endings. I mean, this is at least one where we can't figure out. I'm pretty sure that none of us can figure out a way that a choice could have been made that would have brought the entire world to an end.
Well, yes, not in that sense. It was a little too low magic for that. But they did kind of mention in the, well, what does my character do next? You know, they kind of foreshadow a possible, you know, future version where, you know, it's like, well, Prospero goes back, but he's just going to get stabbed in the back again because, you know, he didn't notice it the first time. So they're going to turn on him because he's like, you know, oh, I'll be merciful and not kill you. And then they're just going to kill him again, you know.
It's his narrative lot in life.
Yeah. So in that future, they kind of foreshadow what could happen. And I was sort of waiting for that to happen at the end of the book, like, you know, where they telescope it and it's like,
we're happy people.
And then it didn't. So that was good, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We kind of needed this book. I think that it was a good cheer up.
Despite some of the dark elements of the content, I really enjoyed this and I give it, if I had more than two thumbs, I'd stick more up, but.
Awesome. All right. Well, now our revels are ended. So unless we've got anything else to say, I think it's time to bring this to a close. All right. Well then, until next time, we are Sci-Fi.
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 Yeah.